Good morning and welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Wednesday, April 1st, and this is our Macro Geopolitics AI Blockchain Edition, packed as always. I'm Maya.
And I'm Alex. And Maya, honestly, diving into this today feels a bit like a blacksmith working a particularly complex piece of steel. You need to understand the core material, apply heat in the right places, and then shape it, because right now the global landscape is undergoing some serious forging.
Always with the analogies, Alex. But seriously, let's get to it. First up, war in Ukraine is reshaping the energy market faster than anyone predicted. Is this a permanent shift in global power dynamics or a temporary scramble?
And that scramble feeds directly into our next theme, global economic confidence. We're seeing nations quietly reassess alliances, but what does economic reformation even look like in a world less reliant on traditional structures?
While the old order shifts, AI isn't waiting. Billions are pouring into the sector, but regulatory hurdles are mounting. Is this explosive growth sustainable, or are we heading for a bubble? I'm particularly interested in the societal impact. It feels like every week there's a new development.
Speaking of bubbles, prepare to be surprised by the numbers we're seeing in private credit. Liquidity is drying up, defaults are rising, and the sector risks are substantial, to say the least.
Substantial is putting it mildly. Let's dive in. Oil prices fluctuating between $110 and $120 a barrel, it's not just a number, it's a pressure gauge on global stability right now. Let's unpack the geopolitical risks driving the energy market.
The data tells a story. The current situation with the U.S.-Iran conflict isn't an isolated event. It's a complex interplay of military posturing, economic leverage, and a deeply rooted history of asymmetric warfare. As Jessica Jenner noted, Iran appears focused on survival, and the Strait of Hormuz is their primary tool for exerting pressure.
Survival isn't about winning a conventional war, then. It's about creating enough disruption to force a withdrawal and holding that disruption capability indefinitely.
That's the core of the strategy. Jenner's point is crucial. Iran doesn't need to defeat the U.S. militarily. Blocking the Strait of Hormuz is a trump card, a permanent bargaining chip. The focus is on enduring leverage, not outright victory. This fundamentally alters the calculus for the U.S.
So the Fed worrying about rate hikes in the face of rising oil prices is misplaced.
Ross Mayfield believes it is. He argues that raising rates would be a policy mistake. High oil prices inevitably lead to demand destruction and economic pullback. Anticipating that contraction in the back half of the year, if oil prices remain elevated, is the more rational approach. The risk of over-tightening is significant.
Doug Krisner and the team at Bloomberg Surveillance saw market sensitivity to de-escalation signals. Does that mean we're basically watching a geopolitical stock ticker?
To some extent, yes. Market reaction is incredibly sensitive, but the underlying uncertainty persists. Trump's statements about a potential end to the conflict within weeks, while initially positive, are questioned given his strategic unpredictability. The market is anticipating a resolution, but factoring in a substantial risk premium.
A risk premium, right? How much of this is built in now? Is it simply the cost of doing business in a volatile region?
The price fluctuations between $110 and $120 demonstrate the premium is already substantial. The difference between generic oil at $118 and Brent crude at $108, as noted by Tom Keene's panel, reflects the war's influence. Investors are essentially pricing in a degree of continued disruption.
What about the emerging markets? Eric Fine pointed out that commodity exporting countries are benefiting from this inflationary environment.
Something to flag here, Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa are specifically highlighted as regions experiencing opportunities. The higher commodity prices translate directly into revenue for those economies, offering a buffer against global headwinds. However, it's a geographically uneven benefit.
But isn't that a bit simplistic? Doesn't this also mean higher import costs for those same countries?
It's a complex dynamic. Johnny Gooden's analysis from EM Fixed Income reveals that EM sovereign credit spreads have widened, signaling growing market concern despite the commodity gains. There's a tension between rising inflation and potential growth slowdowns. It's not a uniform positive.
So EM rates markets are showing a flattening one-year yield curve. What does that even mean for the average investor?
It's a signal of uncertainty. Anishka Kristova explains it reflects central bank reactions being priced in, anticipation of either de-escalation or growth concerns. The market isn't sure which way things will go, and central banks are positioned to respond to either scenario.
And that's all happening alongside the broader macroeconomic context. Ben Ramsey noted that 2022 Russia-Ukraine is different than this energy shock.
Significantly different. Higher baseline U.S. Treasury yields and positive real rates, coupled with EM economies having built buffers since the pandemic, reduce the risk of a repeat of widespread defaults. The system is more resilient, but still vulnerable.
Vulnerable how?
Spread movements in EM credit are split 50-50 between credit risk and US Treasury movements. It's a complex interplay. While buffers exist, US Treasury performance remains a major influence. The risk of a broader financial contagion isn't zero.
Okay, let's talk about the US withdrawal. Jessica Genwer said it's politically harder for Trump than for Israel to unilaterally pull out. Why?
The association of the oil crisis with Trump's actions. The world sees him as the primary driver of the instability. Unilateral withdrawal would be perceived as a failure, whereas Israel can claim success in degrading Iran's military capabilities.
Trump might pressure Netanyahu to withdraw as well.
Genwer suggests that's a possibility. Israel has already achieved many of its objectives, and pursuing separate operations in Lebanon complicates the situation. Trump may see forcing a coordinated withdrawal as the most politically palatable solution.
Let's jump to Tom Keene's panel with Lindsay Newman and Eric Fine. Operation Epic Fury, that's a name.
It's President Trump's strategy for achieving lasting peace in the Middle East, despite contradictions with earlier promises. Newman suggests it may be his approach, but it's a highly unconventional one. The ambition for a Nobel Peace Prize is a driving factor.
Ambition as a foreign policy strategy. That feels precarious.
It is.
But it explains why Trump might prioritize a specific outcome, a rewriting of regional history over conventional diplomatic approaches. It's a consistent thread in his decision-making.
Okay, so Trump wants a win, but Iran only needs to survive. We've established that. But what about the Strait of Hormuz specifically? What does a closed strait look like?
Libby Cantrell at PIMCO identified a critical asymmetry. U.S. withdrawal without reopening the strait won't resolve the underlying physical supply issues. Even if a political resolution is reached, the return of 12 million barrels per day of shut-in production isn't guaranteed.
The refining market, though. Vikas Dwivedi pointed out the 3 to 4 million barrels per day of damage in the Middle East.
The implication runs deeper. That's a critical bottleneck. Refining capacity is a potential issue, needing run cuts to rebalance the market. Damage to refineries prolongs the recovery, even after crude production resumes. It's a less discussed vulnerability.
And what about the broader trade implications? Cantrell also mentioned strained U.S.-Europe relations.
Strained relations hinder a unified response. Europe's security spending is a point of contention. A coordinated effort to secure the strait is more difficult without European buy-in. It adds another layer of complexity.
Okay, so let's assume, for the sake of argument, that Trump declares victory without reopening the strait. What happens then?
As Cantrell notes, it removes the risk premium but doesn't address the physical supply issues. Iran leverages the strait as a permanent bargaining chip, controlling access based on tanker friendliness. It reframes the conflict not as a purely geopolitical issue, but as a domestic political problem tied to consumer affordability.
So it's about gas prices. Always about gas prices.
The need to demonstrate tangible benefits to voters following the 2024 election is a key constraint. Declining gas prices, even if it requires a rhetorical victory, is the priority.
It's like trying to negotiate with your landlord while simultaneously promising everyone a discount.
A remarkably apt analogy, actually. The conflicting demands and the need for a face-saving outcome create a highly unstable situation.
And the UK? Hesitancy to support operations driven by domestic fiscal issues.
It demonstrates how geopolitics is increasingly affected by domestic constraints. Re-establishing deterrence in the strait is challenging when allies lack the political appetite.
Okay, final thought. All this, the risk premium, the strait, the potential withdrawal, is it just a temporary blip, or are we looking at a fundamental shift in global power dynamics?
The current energy shock, as Ben Ramsey pointed out, differs fundamentally from 2022. While the immediate impact is significant, the built-up buffers and higher baseline treasury yields mitigate the risk of a systemic crisis. But the long-term implications, Iran's enduring leverage, the potential for continued disruption, and the shift in European defense procurement, suggest a more fragmented and unstable world order. It's less about a single event and more about a protracted state of competition.
The real story isn't about oil prices themselves, but the infrastructure built around them, insurance rates, refining capacity, geopolitical alliances that are now being stress-tested. It's like discovering your plumbing was held together by sheer luck, and now a slightly bigger leak is revealing the whole system is about to collapse.
Worth noting that stress test ultimately will dictate the trajectory of global confidence.
Peter Atwater says powerlessness is rising and nobody is ready. Does that feel accurate?
Undeniably. It's not just a feeling, but a quantifiable shift in investor behavior and policymaking, driven by a widening chasm between an incredibly resilient elite and a population losing economic footing. The data points to a cyclical confidence crisis, and we're clearly entering a vulnerability phase after a prolonged period of hubris, a fourth turning, as Jem describes it.
A fourth turning. Right up. So societal collapse is on the menu.
Not necessarily collapse, but a reformation. Think about it, the Fed's nominal illusion of prosperity is crumbling, and the inherent instability of the petrodollar system is intensifying. The U.S.-China dynamic, centered around energy control, is accelerating a wartime economy mentality, where rational economic principles are increasingly secondary to geopolitical interests.
A wartime economy. That's a polite way to put it. It sounds like decisions are being made based on settling scores, as Atwater puts it, Khashoggi as a precedent.
Stepping back, that mindset directly correlates with impulsive, uncontrolled responses. Look at post-9/11 interventions or the reaction to the Hamas attack. Policymakers operate with interests, not principles, and when confidence is low, those interests become ruthlessly prioritized. Pippa Malmgren's observation about accepting economic costs for geopolitical gains underscores that shift.
So the market is pricing in war now. War beta. Seriously?
It is.
The weaponization of financial markets is blatant. Investors are actively searching for correlations between geopolitical events and asset performance, creating a dangerous feedback loop. Everything is interconnected, and the systemic risk is escalating exponentially. It's like watching a wildfire. Confidence initially fuels its slow spread, but once it hits dry brush, it becomes uncontrollable.
Wildfires. Okay. And AI is helping.
Ironically, yes and no. It's deflationary in nature, but it's also facing a populist backlash. Atwater draws a parallel to the breakup of AT&T. Government regulation is inevitable. The tech space, as he puts it, doesn't see what's coming.
The tech space never sees what's coming.
The pattern is clear, the abstract nature of AI, the threat to employment, it's a perfect storm. And that backlash will likely be inflationary, counteracting the deflationary effects of the technology itself. UBI price controls, it's a reversal of the COVID experience, where the intervention outweighed the initial shock.
So AI lowers costs, the government spends more to placate the masses, and inflation persists.
That's the likely scenario. Jim identifies a disconnect in current AI analysis. The political environment will outweigh the technological one. It's a move towards authoritarianism, driven by the inevitable costs of addressing inequality and a desire to maintain control.
Conveniently, is a draft on the table. Atwater mentioned that as a critical escalation.
And it signals a loss of power for those at the bottom, further eroding consumer confidence. The volunteer army's disproportionate impact on lower socioeconomic groups is a key data point here. Policymakers consistently underappreciate the economic consequences of their actions.
Which, if I understand correctly, is because they rarely interact with anyone outside their bubble. Hospital emergency rooms are apparently the primary contact point now.
That's right. The stratification of socioeconomic experiences is creating a dangerous disconnect. Those in power are losing grasp of the realities faced by those at the bottom, increasing the likelihood of spontaneous, impulsive reactions.
So when things break, they won't even see it coming.
Confidence beyond a certain point creates blindness. It reduces scrutiny, attention to overlooked risks, making policymakers vulnerable to unexpected shocks. Tom Hanks contracting COVID sparked a massive response, a small trigger but a huge reaction.
Which brings us back to powerlessness. Atwater says it's the defining feeling of 2026.
Combined with existing uncertainty, it will drive significant shifts. And the shift from a traditional economy to a wartime economy means resources are being diverted to state goals, fundamentally altering market dynamics. Recognizing this shift is crucial for wealth creation.
Because state allocation now dominates.
There's a signal here, policymakers in wartime operate based on interests, necessitating oppressive measures. They do not have friends, they have interests, as Atwater observes, an investment strategy now revolves around understanding and aligning with the priorities of a small group of powerful individuals, perhaps a dozen globally, who currently drive the economy.
12 people deciding the fate of the world. That's terrifying.
It's a simplification, but not inaccurate. And it explains the increasing institutionalization of the hedge fund industry, the challenges for smaller firms, and the favoring of those with robust compliance infrastructure. Capital flows to strong strategies, but episodic shifts require emotional resilience and a long-term perspective.
Emotional resilience. That's a lot to ask when the system is actively working against you.
And that leads to the vulnerability of AI. Its abstract nature and threat to employment will trigger a wild backlash, mirroring historical patterns like the AT&T breakup. The tech space is unprepared. Government intervention is inevitable, likely occurring within 4 to 6 years, motivated by a growing threat from corporate power, especially in the context of AI.
4 to 6 years. Wonderful. So what actually breaks first? Given all of this,
the most immediate vulnerability is consumer confidence. The combination of geopolitical instability, rising inequality, and the weaponization of financial markets is eroding trust in the system. We'll see a fundamental shift in investment preferences, a move away from risk assets and towards tangible security, real assets, commodities, potentially even alternative currencies. The wealthy, disconnected from economic realities, will accelerate this trend, driving a self-fulfilling prophecy of instability. The K-shaped inequality will become a chasm, and the system, already fragile, will fracture along those lines.
So the wealthy build bunkers, everyone else what?
Everyone else attempts to navigate a system increasingly defined by scarcity and control. And that's where the conversation shifts to AI, because the need for a new economic model, a new power infrastructure, is becoming increasingly urgent. The AI boom isn't just a technological revolution. It's a forcing function, compelling a renewed focus on the fundamentals of energy access and resilience.
OpenAI considering an adult mode in October 2025 feels predictable, doesn't it? Like a historical inevitability.
It absolutely does. The source material points to a recurring pattern, from early cameras to the internet. Pornography is often among the first applications of new technology. OpenAI repeatedly underestimated this, even after experiencing it with AI Dungeon. It's not a moral failing necessarily, but a strategic miscalculation.
Strategic as in, Sam Altman acknowledges erotica would likely boost revenue.
Two things stand out. He frames the debate not as a question of right or wrong, but as a risk assessment between short-term gains and potential brand damage. The initial delay to December 2025, and now October 2025, isn't a principled stand. It's a calculated pause to manage user alignment. It's a fascinating case study in the commercial pressures facing AI companies.
A case study where the Expert Council on Well-being in AI unanimously opposed the launch, but here we are.
That disconnect is critical. The council's role appears more performative than substantive, suggesting a willingness to prioritize commercial interests even when expert advice conflicts with safety concerns. And it's not just about OpenAI, this dynamic will be common across the industry.
100 million users under 18, and a 12% misclassification rate in age verification, that's roughly 12 million minors potentially accessing explicit content.
So here's the picture, the limitations of current age-gating technology are stark. While industry standard, that 12% error rate translates to a significant, quantifiable safety risk. The tragic suicide of the 14-year-old boy following interactions with a character AI chatbot underscores the potential for real-world harm. It's a problem that isn't going away with scale.
So the question becomes, what does regulation look like when you're dealing with a technology that inherently attracts this kind of use?
That's the core challenge. The lawsuits against Meta and Google, focusing on product liability rather than Section 230, offer a potential roadmap. Plaintiffs are arguing negligent design, which bypasses First Amendment protections. If that precedent holds, AI companies could face similar claims based on addictive features and harmful content generation.
Robert Armstrong remains skeptical of a large-scale impact, citing past tech litigation failures.
His cynicism is understandable given his experience. However, the scale of AI investment and the potential for systemic harm are different. The current investment cycle is already exceeding the size of the Apollo space program and the U.S. highway program. It's not comparable to Java or Android suits.
Speaking of investment, the cusp of a CapEx supercycle report suggests AI is additive to economic growth, and hyperscaler investment is at 2% of GDP, a level last seen during the railway era.
We can trace that further, that's a key point. While some investment represents reallocation, the overall trend is expected to be additive. The shift from just-in-time to just-in-case supply chains, driven by geopolitical shocks, necessitates hardware investment, benefiting companies like Nvidia and Marvell.
And Europe anticipating a significant increase in defense spending, moving from 1.5% to 5% of GDP.
It reinforces the macro theme. Geopolitical instability is driving demand across multiple sectors, AI, energy, defense fueling this investment cycle. China's investment ratio peaking and declining further concentrates the boom in advanced economies.
So if this cycle lasts around 10 years and is symmetric around the peak, we're looking at accelerating investment for the next 5 years, potentially leading to higher real interest rates.
That's the consensus view. The commodity-intensive nature of the cycle will likely contribute to continued price pressures. Investment to GDP ratios could reach or exceed levels seen in the 1990s by the end of the decade.
But even with all this investment, Hannah Murphy points out the deliberate silence surrounding Section 230 implications for AI chatbots.
That's a significant, unacknowledged risk. Companies are hesitant to discuss liability for content generated by their own products. The potential for AI-generated content to trigger legal challenges is enormous, and the regulatory framework is still undefined.
And Katie Martin notes a lack of attention to the radicalization of non-children online.
That's a critical blind spot. The focus on children is important, but the broader societal harm, radicalization, misinformation, isn't receiving the same scrutiny. It highlights the limitations of the current discourse and the potential for unintended consequences.
It feels like we're only seeing the first ripple of this. OpenAI's internal debate, the legal challenges against social media giants, the investment cycle, it's all connected.
But the fundamental question remains, can we effectively regulate a technology that is evolving so rapidly, and can we mitigate the societal risks without stifling innovation? Honestly, I don't know. The unpredictability of user behavior, the inherent difficulty of content moderation, and the complex geopolitical implications, it's a uniquely challenging situation.
12 million minors potentially accessing explicit content. That's a number that deserves more than just a footnote. And frankly, the fact that we're casually discussing AI-driven geopolitical shifts while barely scratching the surface of safety concerns feels concerning, to say the least. Which brings us to private credit's growing pains, where liquidity, defaults, and sector risks are starting to look less like isolated events and more like systemic vulnerabilities. The narrative that private credit is on the brink of a systemic meltdown, overblown, wouldn't you say? It feels like a lot of hand-wringing over features that were designed to prevent meltdowns.
I agree. The liquidity provisions, specifically in non-traded BDCs, aren't a bug, they're a deliberate structure. Vishy Turupatter and David Miller both highlighted that roughly 10% of those portfolios are allocated to broadly syndicated loans precisely to facilitate exits when needed, preventing forced sales and systemic risk. The idea isn't instant convertibility, it's about having a buffer.
Facilitate exits. Right?
Translation, they keep some stuff handy they can dump if things get hairy. But let's be real, that buffer isn't infinite. What's the current temperature on actual distress beyond the broad concern?
Overall defaults are around 5%, which isn't alarming. However, the software sector is showing isolated pressure, with a higher exposure than high yield. The CIO Roundtable podcast series indicated loans exhibit 14% software exposure versus 4% for high yield, which explains why loans initially took more of a hit during the February AI disruption.
February. That was fun. AI fears, Iran tensions, everyone flipping sectors faster than a crypto investor. And that's the crux of it, isn't it? These aren't isolated events. The dynamic between geopolitical events and AI disruption fears is creating a rapid performance flip-flop, as the roundtable pointed out.
The initial resilience of high yield, driven by low software exposure, quickly reversed with the Iran conflict. Conversely, loans suffered from AI fears but stabilized as the geopolitical focus shifted. This illustrates the heightened sector sensitivity and the potential for rapid repricing.
Repricing being code for opportunity for investors who aren't panicking. David Miller anticipated a correction as retail flows moderate, suggesting better entry points. But retail flows, weren't they part of the problem?
They were initially. The recent influx of retail capital tightened spreads and weakened terms. However, that trend is reversing. Crucially, portfolio construction for retail accounts is mirroring institutional strategies, meaning less indiscriminate buying and a return to more selective credit allocation.
So the amateurs are becoming slightly less amateurish.
Good.
But even with smarter retail money, software is still the weak link. Fitch reported no defaults YTD as of March 31, 2026, but that's a snapshot. What's driving the vulnerability?
Loans were negatively impacted earlier this year by AI disruption, concerns specifically within the software sector. The Bloomberg data also emphasizes that liquidity assessment requires a nuanced approach beyond simple bid-offer spreads. Their machine learning model factors in time, cost, and volume, revealing a more realistic picture of actual liquidity.
A more realistic picture meaning it's harder to get out than it looks. And if AI keeps evolving, that sector's pain could spread. The market is at 9-month highs in spread and yield, presenting a carry opportunity, but I'm hesitant.
Caution is warranted. The speakers advocate a higher quality segments and waiting for conflict resolution before increasing exposure to more credit-sensitive areas. It's a selective approach.
Selective being the operative word. Looking ahead beyond the next geopolitical flare-up, I think the key is watching how quickly AI models can be adapted to assess credit risk. If machine learning truly converges public and private markets, as Brad Foster suggests, the hidden exposures in private credit will become a lot less hidden.
That's a crucial point. The ability of AI to provide a more granular, real-time view of creditworthiness and to factor in the accelerating pace of technological disruption will be paramount. Will we see a standardization of risk modeling across both public and private markets by, say, the end of 2027? That's the question.
Standardization or a widening gap as the private market lags. Either way, it's a trend worth keeping a very close eye on. And if AI doesn't catch up, we're looking at a potential wave of sector-specific defaults, particularly within software, well before anyone sees it coming. Pulling back from the specifics, the oil price fluctuations, the AI investment frenzy, the private credit jitters, it feels like we've been mapping a single, incredibly complex system under stress. It wasn't about isolated events, but the interconnectedness of everything. We talked about geopolitical leverage through energy disruption and the way that's forcing a reevaluation of economic alliances, but that feels like the cause of the economic vulnerability, not separate from it.
It's a telling detail. And what we're seeing isn't just a recalibration, it's a fundamental shift in the operating assumptions of the last 30 years. The idea of a stable, predictable global order is eroding, and the buffers those trillions built up in sovereign wealth funds, the relatively low default rates in private credit, they're less about systemic strength and more about buying time. It's like discovering the plumbing was held together by sheer luck, and now a slightly bigger leak is revealing the whole system is about to collapse.
And AI is both accelerating that stress and offering a potential, albeit imperfect, solution. Billions flowing into a sector that could deflate costs, increase productivity, but also radically disrupt employment, and as we saw with the age verification data, create entirely new vectors of risk. The 100 million users under 18 on OpenAI alone feels significant.
Significant is an understatement. It's a parallel acceleration, the speed of technological change outpacing the capacity for societal adaptation and regulation. The standardization of risk modeling, something we discussed ending 2027, is crucial. Because right now we have a blind spot, a 14% software exposure in loans versus 4% in high yield. That's a war beta waiting to be revealed. The private credit market, with its 10% allocation to broadly syndicated loans, is incredibly sensitive to these shifts.
So if the system is under stress, AI is both the accelerant and a potential diagnostic tool. And the geopolitical tensions. They're not just a pressure gauge on global stability, they're actively shaping the economic landscape. The US-China dynamic, leaning towards a wartime economy mentality around energy control, feels almost inevitable.
It does. And it's worth remembering that conflict resolution, as the market seems to be pricing in, isn't necessarily about peaceful outcomes. It's about face-saving outcomes, about allowing major actors to adjust their positions without losing too much prestige. The real risk isn't necessarily a full-scale war, but the continued weaponization of financial markets as a bargaining tactic.
Which gets us back to the investment cycle. You predicted 10 years of accelerating investment, potentially leading to higher real interest rates. That feels counterintuitive in a contractionary environment.
But this isn't a conventional cycle. It's driven by a need to rebuild infrastructure, not just physical infrastructure, but the entire architecture of supply chains, moving towards a just-in-case model. It's an ambitious foreign policy strategy disguised as economic growth. And frankly, it's a gamble.
A gamble and one where the sustainability of those buffers, the 2% of GDP in hyperscaler investment, the 1.5% to 5% increase in European defense spending, remains to be seen. It's a lot of moving parts, and the role of retail investors, their increasing sophistication, feels like another unknown.
And if I were to attempt a comedic analogy, it's like negotiating with your landlord while simultaneously promising everyone a discount. The timing has to be perfect, and the whole thing could fall apart at any moment. But here we are.
Here we are. Thanks for joining us.
We'll be back tomorrow to unpack whatever new piece of this puzzle emerges.